Hello and welcome to the Heard It Here podcast, a production of the W.D. Hoard & Sons Company. My name is Abby Bauer, and I'm an editor for Hordes Dairyman magazine. I am pleased to be with you for this episode of the Heard It Here podcast. Our conversation will focus on salmonella, a disease that is dreaded by dairy farmers. We will discuss what salmonella is, how it impacts cows and calves, and what we can do to treat and prevent this challenging disease. Our sponsor for this episode is Boehringer Ingelheim, a pharmaceutical company focused on improving the lives of animals and humans. Check them out online at Boehringer-Ingelheim.com. Now, I am really excited to introduce to you our guest, Keith Polson. Dr. Polson is a clinical assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. For the last 5 years, he has also served as the director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. He is active in several professional veterinary organizations, and some of his main areas of interest are cattle health, zoonotic infectious diseases, and global health. Dr. Polson is a Wisconsin native and graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He spent some time at North Carolina State University and Oregon State University before returning to his Badger State roots. Keith, welcome to the Heard It Here podcast.
Thanks for having me, Abby.
Very good. I am fortunate to work with Keith as one of our regular authors for Hordes Dairyman magazine, but it's a real treat to be able to talk in person about an important cattle health issue today. So I look forward to the discussion that we will have. I think we'll start off with a really high-level overview of what is salmonella. Can you just give us a little background information here?
Sure. So salmonella is in the category of pathogens of bacteria, and specifically it's a gram-negative bacteria. So when we're thinking about pathogens on the farm, we typically think of viruses, bacteria, and then mold and fungi, and salmonella itself is in that gram negative, so it's commonly found in feces and dirt in the environment, but it's typically spread fecal oral amongst cattle, and it's considered an infectious disease. And then it also has a zoonotic component, meaning that it potentially could infect people, different strains of it.
What are the most common ways that maybe you see salmonella spread on a dairy farm?
We are coming in to salmonella season. And typically when we think about salmonella, we're talking about salmonella enterica. And there's several thousand different strains and serotypes and then thousands of strains. And they all have kind of different characteristics. We group them into serogroups. But typically cattle are going to share salmonella from fecal oral contamination, or we could have things like contaminated feedstuffs or water, but typically it's from fecal contamination of the environment, maybe the fresh pen or a calf that's shedding that then other calves in the environment are exposed to.
Maybe if we start with cows, what are some of the symptoms that are associated with salmonella and what would help tip you off that you might have a salmonella infection in your herd?
Right. Yeah. And it can be quite complicated. So when we think about that, different salmonellas do different things. So when we think about our top five, it changes a little bit year to year, but our top five serotypes and species that we isolate at the diagnostic lab, we isolate a couple thousand a year. And our top five are Salmonella Dublin, Ciro, Typhimurium, Newport, Montevideo, and Kentucky. And every year they kind of jostle around for those top five. And each one of those is going to have different clinical presentations. So our Salmonella Ciros tend to be maybe cows that maybe just have a little bit of diarrhea versus our Salmonella Dublin, where we might see things like abortion, pneumonia, and GI signs like diarrhea. I think in the end, when it's great to have diagnostics. Now, I'm coming from a diagnostic lab where, of course, I would love diagnostics on every animal every day, but it's just not really practical, right? So when we have changes in animal health that aren't either responding to treatment protocols or we have sick animals that all of a sudden we see a slug of animals that are sick, or maybe it looks different than the normal baseline morbidity or disease on the farm, which every farm has, that's when we want to submit diagnostics to make sure we know what's happening on the farm. Typically, when we think of salmonella in adult cows, it's either going to be like Dublin, could see abortion or diarrhea, or really severe diarrhea with something like a salmonella typhimurium or a Newport.
Is there a time of the year where you're more likely to see infections in adult cattle?
Yeah, and kind of infections in general, in Wisconsin, we're going to see more in the warm, wet weather. So salmonella likes really warm, wet weather, opposite of some of our other pathogens like coronaviruses. Coronaviruses like cold, dry weather. So, yeah, the warm, wet that we're coming into in June and July is where we see our peak salmonella seasons in Wisconsin.
Maybe to step back a moment, obviously you work a lot with testing, like you said, at the diagnostic laboratory. If someone was going to send in samples, maybe could you describe that process a little bit? Maybe how they decide what animals to test and then what do you have to do to send in a sample?
Yeah, so when we're testing animals, typically if we recognize the clinical signs that are synonymous with maybe some of our viruses, bacteria, and parasites, we'll submit fecal samples, and that's just a fecal sample in a milk cultured vial, just so we can seal it nice and tight so it doesn't leak around the package. And your veterinarian will help you submit those samples. For all of our samples, we actually require a veterinarian to do it, because even though we're veterinarians here at the lab, I'm not on the farm. So I need to know a lot about the history of what's going on, what the animals have been treated with, how old are the animals, when are they getting sick. So that's a little bit different in our aged cows versus our calves. So our aged cows, we want to know where they are in lactation. Is it a particular string of cows? Is it dry cows, fresh lactating cows, transition cows, or mid-lactation? And then our calves are, what kind of, are they typically, they present with diarrhea, and Salmonella Dublin can present a little bit differently. But that history coming in and when they're being infected, what they're being treated with, and how successful that treatment is. But so for adult cows, it's usually just a fecal sample that we either run a PCR test and or a culture. So the PCR is a very sensitive test that we can find a salmonella species, and then we culture them out to know exactly what species we're dealing with. And then we tend to then submit those for antimicrobial susceptibility, so we know which antimicrobials they're susceptible and resistant to. And as many of us know, our salmonella strains are very often what we call multi-drug resistant. So just the, frontline drugs like a penicillin, typically salmonellas are not susceptible to those. So we have to really critically think about, if we're going to treat an animal with an antimicrobial, that we're picking the right drug.
We know that Wisconsin has a diagnostic laboratory. What, if people live in other parts of the country, are there a lot of options out there? What do you recommend people do if they're looking for somewhere to send a sample?
Yep. So just like all diagnostic labs, if you're looking, a lot of labs specialize. Most states have a state diagnostic lab. So about 60% of those labs are part of a university system, and about the remaining 40% are typically through like a state animal health department. And then there's private labs out there. So we have private labs in clinics or IDEX or ANTEC. But for the majority, for food animal, specifically for fecal and salmonella diagnostics, they're probably going to be a state veterinary diagnostic lab. And so I think the best resource for animal owners is speaking to their veterinarian about who are they most comfortable with submitting their salmonella diagnostics to. Now, not all labs specialize in salmonella. Some labs will grow salmonella and they'll send it to our national lab at Ames for serotyping and speciation. And then some of the other labs like Wisconsin or Cornell or Iowa, Davis, we specialize in salmonella and food animals. So we will typically serotype and speciate in-house because we can do that much faster. There isn't transit time in between the labs because we know how important it is to get those diagnostics back in an appropriate or the shortest amount of time possible, because we know that there's sick and or dying animals on the farm.
if someone finds out that they have a salmonella case on hand or cows with salmonella, what are your recommendations for treatment for adult cattle?
Sure. And, you know, we have this discussion quite a bit with our veterinarians and our physician counterparts here on campus and when we're talking to our human populations, because, you know, people get salmonella as well. And really the our treatment recommendations are the same as people, is that we try not to use antimicrobials. So we don't like to use antibiotic drugs. We like to treat them supportively with lots of oral or intravenous fluid therapy. And then only use antimicrobials for those really complicated cases, or maybe an animal that's immunocompromised, but they're going to need some more diagnostics as well, because we know that, you know, salmonella we can see outbreaks on a farm, that salmonellas tend not to be very susceptible to antibiotics. So we try not to use them. Now that's pretty challenging when you're talking to an animal owner that they see that they have a sick animal due to a bacterial infection. It's the same thing in people that go to urgent care that have salmonellosis from either catching it from an animal or in the environment, or maybe contaminated food. So we try to do supportive care as by far and away the most important component. And then secondarily, we go towards antibiotics if we think that that case really needs it. Now, there's a couple other different things that we add besides fluid therapy and supportive care. It might be things like probiotics or prebiotics. So there's lots of different products out there that are either feed additives or that are really designed to support the natural normal flora in the GI tract, because that's really what outcompetes salmonella as a pathogen. And we would consider that supportive care as well.
It's interesting to hear about the similarities between human treatment and cattle treatment when trying to tackle this issue on farms. What would you recommend people put in place to prevent salmonella infections? Does that include vaccinations, or what other protocols could be instilled on the farm? And let's continue to focus on the adult cattle first, and we'll tackle calves in a little bit.
Sure. So we focus with our kind of consulting services at the diagnostic lab, and most veterinarians know that the most important or most effective way to either prevent and or decrease salmonella infections on a farm is cleaning and sanitation. Now, unfortunately, that's probably the most labor intensive, and it's the hardest thing to actually implement on a farm. So, you know, we think about when we're talking about cleaning and sanitation, we're not just talking about, does it look clean? Does the environment look clean? It's really thinking about taking all the organic material out of a transition pen or a fresh pen, as we're taking all the organic out and we're actually cleaning it, disinfecting it and sanitizing it before we repopulate it with animals. Now there's multiple different steps in there. It's really labor intensive, but that by far and away is our best way to control salmonella on a farm, and either prevent it prevent it when it comes into the salmonella season, like what we're coming into right now this summer in the upper Midwest. We might see more of it in the earlier springs in the southern warmer parts of the country, when we do see positive animals or salmonella coming, because it likes to stay in the environment, and we'll see it every year because it really adapts well to stick around in the environment, forms these really long hyphal chains, and just like it will survive in dry dust in the barn until it gets wet and warm, and then it grows really well again. So we're cleaning and sanitation to kind of break that cycle. And then when we think about, there are, for the listeners out there, we all know that there's multiple different types of vaccines available. Now, the vaccines most of the vaccines, there's a couple different types. One is a gram-negative core vaccine, which is just kind of a ground-up salmonella that really increases the cow's immune response or ability to manage gram-negative bacteria in general. So gram-negative, like Klebsiella, E. coli, salmonella, those would be our top three. And then we have salmonella-specific vaccines that might be towards a particular serotype, like a Salmonella Dublin. We have a Salmonella Dublin modified live vaccine. And then we have other type of vaccines, which are, they were new 10 years ago or 10 or 15 years ago, is that there's Salmonella vaccines that actually go after very specific proteins in the Salmonella bacteria itself, so they have the inability to take in nutrients. Now, most of those vaccines, whether it's a toxic mastitis kind of gram-negative core, or specific to a particular salmonella itself, or to a nutrient to limit nutrients and growth, is that they're not going to prevent infection of salmonella. What they try, what you know, really the purpose of those vaccines is to decrease the clinical signs, right? So we're decreasing morbidity and mortality. So we're still going to see a baseline level of salmonella, and it's not going to get rid of it. But hopefully, we won't have as many cows that are sick with the same amount of milk drop. Or hopefully we don't have the same mortality. We see fewer dead cows or calves in our younger group. So I think it salmon there is no one kind of magic bullet. I mean, and that's really what we tend to see, especially in an emergency, right? We want to know what antibiotic can we use, what vaccine can we use right now, and many vaccines, even for salmonellas in Wisconsin and different states have different laws. But we'll isolate a salmonella and then make what we call an autogenous vaccine, where we can use that vaccine from the salmonella isolated on that farm to expose other cattle to so they develop an immune response to it, to hopefully decrease clinical signs. But not one of those interventions or management strategies is going to completely stop an outbreak and prevent it 100% in the future. It really focuses on cleaning, sanitation, or cleaning, disinfection, and sanitation. And then when we have problems outside of that, or we have maybe facilities that we just can't do a very good job with, then we have other tools like a vaccine or other dietary additives like a prebiotic or a probiotic, whether it's a yeast cell wall extract or some other type of nutritional additive to help us maintain or prevent or minimize clinical signs due to salmonellosis.
Certainly sounds like a multi-pronged approach to try
Yep.
to keep salmonella at bay. When you talk about disinfecting and sanitation, are there certain ingredients or certain products that you would recommend for farms, or is it more in the process and the water used? Maybe if you could go a little more, give a little more detail about that.
Yeah, so we have quite a bit of those resources on our website, and I think there's multiple different vendors and different types of disinfectants that are out there. Moving from, you know, really that cleaning stage of all the organic debris out, and then doing as a wash and really scrubbing and making sure the organic debris is out, and then coming through with the disinfectant step, and then leaving the disinfectant on for a longer period of time. Making sure it's rinsed and then following with the sanitation step. And then other parts that we see, and these are some of the things that I w who wrote that on our for our web materials is Dr. Don Sockett. And we kind of follow some of his recommendations along with some of the other experts in the field. I think there's multiple different products that are out there. I couldn't be able to tell you one that's better than another. And I would say working with your veterinarian and what you have available to see, you know, the inputs that are going in, making sure that they're cost effective for the in that return on investment, and to do what you need, because you're going to put a bunch of effort into this, whether it's a foaming spray or just brushing and manual labor. And the time that it takes to have good coverage for the disinfectants and the sanitizing steps, and then making sure we have a good rinse each time, and then there's plenty of time for everything to dry. When we think about, you know, even just ultraviolet light and it is helpful as well, but taking it down to that cleaning, disinfection, and then sanitation step, it can get quite intensive. And I think then on each farm, you kind of have your own individual, how do I get something that like this gold standard protocol to fit into my operation, whether it's in, you know, northern Wisconsin or North Carolina, where the climates are going to be quite different.
That cleaning process, as you mentioned, certainly can be very time consuming and hard for some farms to be able to fit into their time budget, but sounds like it's a very important part of the salmonella prevention strategy and really preventing a lot of diseases that can impact our dairy cattle. So, an important step there. As we continue this conversation, I want to thank our listeners for joining us. I also would like to thank Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health for sponsoring this episode of the Herd It Here podcast. You can provide early protection against Salmonella Dublin by vaccinating healthy calves that are 2 weeks of age or older with Intervene D, a vaccine offered by Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health. Now, let's move on to calves. So what are some of the main symptoms that would be associated with Salmonella in calves? And maybe if you want to talk first about what types of Salmonella, what strains are most likely to impact dairy calves?
Sure. So, yeah, especially in Salmonella season when we're bringing out and we're seeing that warm, wet weather and Salmonella flourishing in the environment. Typically, you know, we're seeing Salmonella. You know, we have the Salmonella Dublin, which is a host-adapted strain of Salmonella, kind of like Salmonella typhi in people. But our Salmonella Dublins tend to cause diarrhea and sepsis, and then they also cause pneumonia. It's a more of an interstitial pneumonia, very different than enzootic calf pneumonia. Typically, it affects them a little bit later. But then when we have our kind of just the most common that we see with the non-Dublin strains are going to be things like diarrheas and calf scours is our most common way that we see it. Now, when are they most affected? It kind of depends on when they're exposed. So, and when do you know when they're exposed? And that's when records and really clearly defining when our animals are getting sick is really important to know, hey, when should we take these diagnostic samples? Because the best time to take diagnostic samples in these calves are right when they're breaking. So if we are all of a sudden, and sometimes we don't have the record of when they start getting sick, we tend to see the record of when we start using things like oral electrolyte solutions or antimicrobials. And they're moving into the where the calf doctors on the farm are starting to treat them. And oftentimes we're a little bit delayed. So coming back and having an adequate way of scoring those calves and really making sure that we're looking at them every day to really hone down and when the youngest animals are being affected, because typically they'll be they're affected at similar time points in their life, especially in that pre-weaning period. So in those calves, they're almost usually GI disease. There are most common serotypes are things like Typhimurium, Montevideo, Kentucky, Ciro. And then we will see Dublin as well. And the kind of the interesting part about Dublin, because it's host adapted and species specific, is that we can see animals that shed or they're persistently infected with Salmonella Dublin, and then they create and then they're risk factors or a nidus of infection for later shedding and propagation of the infection on the farm. And some of those calves that we see, it's very common to see pneumonia issues and Salmonella Dublin outbreaks in 3 to 6 month old calves. And they present very differently than just your run of the mill enzootic calf pneumonia. And they tend to be quite sick because they have septicemia and they have an interstitial pneumonia. So they can a very different presentation than our typical, you know, 10 to 14 day old calf or a group of calves that are on milk that they start breaking with diarrhea, let's say 10 days of age. And some of our calves, I should probably say this too, is that, you know, because, it, you know, Salmonella on a farm, if our adult cows, and typically that's where our adult cows will be carrying Salmonella and shedding off and on, not all of them are going to get sick, or they, because they're, you know, they're older, a little bit more robust, and they have that, you know, their immune system is a little bit more developed. They can carry Salmonella and shed with or without clinical signs. They don't all have to be sick. But when they're stressed and in that fresh pen and the transition, they'll be shedding Salmonella. And when calves are infected in the fresh pen, right when they're born, they tend to see Salmonella a little bit earlier. And that's where, you know, that those constant records of when are our calves getting infected really helps us kind of point back where do we think the risk factor for those calves are actually getting exposed. Are they getting sick at 3 to 5 days? So then we look at calf processing at birth in the fresh pen, or maybe are we looking at 14 to 21 days and maybe they're being exposed a little bit later when they're a week of age and then they develop disease over that next week. So the more data that we have, the more epidemiological data really helps us focus in to so we can be more efficient in our resource uses, be that treatment, prevention or diagnostics to really know what we're dealing with.
It's clear that that record-keeping piece is very important to try to track down the source. I'm sure, especially with calves, and all of a sudden you have a group of sick calves and you're really stressing and worrying and just trying to take care of them. It might be hard to think back on what was happening a few days ago or a few weeks ago on the farm.
Right.
But that makes sense. What would you recommend for treatment for calves that have either tested with salmonella or a suspected outbreak on a dairy?
Yeah, so I think many of our calves with salmonellosis, they, as a farm recognizes that they're recognizing the case, and maybe they submitted diagnostics early and then they see repeat cases or maybe the next season, and they're going to recognize a calf that's off milk, may or may not have a fever, and they have diarrhea that sometimes has a blood flux in it. And that's kind of a common thing that we see in our adults and our calves is scours with blood in it. And when we go to treat those calves, our treatment, kind of our goals are very similar to our adult cows, is that supportive care and making sure that we're keeping these calves hydrated, and not only hydrated, but keeping their pH balance, because oftentimes calves that are severely dehydrated because of calf scours, they'll pH will drop from lactic acidosis and dehydration. So there, we need to make sure that we're keeping their pH in a normal physiologic range, because when you're acidotic, those calves get really weak and they don't want to stand up, they don't want to drink. So that supportive care really focuses on fluid therapy, and depending on the age of the calf or how severely dehydrated those calves are, will change our kind of intensity of therapy. And for calves in general, we kind of think about that calf that maybe is caught early in a stage of disease, and this is really no different, whether it's Cryptosporidia, E. coli, or something like a salmonellosis, is that when they're standing and nursing it, they're much easier to treat. And then when they, as they get more severe, they tend to lose their suckle reflex because their pH is dropping, or they might be not willing to stand. And then when they get really severe, they'll actually kind of be laying on their side, or what we call lateral recumbency. And that's when we know that without a suckle reflex is that those calves are pretty severely dehydrated and sick. And some people will look, and we actually have studies, and these studies are getting to be quite a bit older, but we'll measure their eyeball recession, because as those calves get really dehydrated, their eyeballs will kind of suck back into their head, because they're losing a lot of their body hydration status. And we can actually measure that and help estimate. But I tend to, and when we teach the students and our practitioners in the field, is really thinking about how severe is that calf? Can it stand? Can it suckle? Or is it down and unable to right itself, or is it in lateral recumbency? So fluid therapy is really important. And the thing about fluids in calves versus cows, well, it's easier that we can give them more fluids with an oral esophageal feeder that can replace more of their deficit, versus a 1,500-pound cow, when they're 10% dehydrated, that's a lot of fluid that we have to replace. And they have this big rumen that we can give them a lot of oral fluids. And with our calves, we'll use things like oral electrolyte solutions, and we have to be careful about, well, where is that water going, and how much can we maximally give a calf safely, so we don't actually cause more harm than good. And then when do we move to intravenous therapy? So, and as we all know, intravenous or IV therapy can be challenging, and it's expensive, and it requires a little bit of expertise to be able to safely place those needles or catheters. And in calves, it's a smaller animal, so we have a smaller volume of fluids that we could administer over time, versus our adult cows, which we're talking about liters and liters and gallons of fluid. So we just think about it as an economy of scale. In our calves, we start with our fluids and decide what goes into those fluids. Can we use oral, or do you need sub-Q and intravenous? And then kind of pushing past that is that, how else do we, are we going to support this calf? Are we going to use things like nonsteroidal drugs like flunix and meglumine? Or are there really sick calves? Do we need to use an antibiotic? Understanding what we're dealing with before we're treating it. And then some of the other supportive things that we provide. And even supportive therapy, even with milk, of small volume therapy or small volume feedings multiple times per day can really help those small meals, making sure the calf is still getting some fluids, and we need to maintain them on nutrition of just thinking about it can what we can provide those calves to really help them get through that period of getting through the infection and then rehydrating and letting their gut rest and heal so they can have a normal diet again.
What are your guidelines for feeding oral electrolytes and how you work that into a milk feeding schedule?
You know, we could spend a whole hour just on oral electrolytes, but the first most important thing for me is read the label instructions. There's 100 different products out there, and that to me means that there's multiple good ones. And it gets to be a little bit more complicated, but you should talk to your veterinarian about picking those products and then have very dedicated standard operating procedures on the farm, because typically our farms are going to have multiple calf feeders, and or maybe there's different calf feeders when on holidays or vacation or weekends. We want everyone to be doing the same thing. And then so taking that product that we decide on, making sure it has the right sugar and salt solution, concentrations, making sure that we're not over mixing them and mixing them as per label instructions. Because just like many of us out there, with a little is good and we just add a little bit more, maybe more is better. That is certainly not the case with oral electrolyte solutions. We don't want to make them too concentrated because they can draw more fluid into the gut and actually create more problems than what they're solving. So picking the right product that has the right osmolality and osmolarity, has some energy substrate for that the calf can actually use and metabolize, because they need those calories, especially if they're not absorbing their milk or milk replacer feeding. And then mixing, and we don't want to mix in milk. That's another really important thing, is that oftentimes it's easier to just put the milk or the or electrolyte solution, whether it's a powder or a liquid, right into the milk. And that makes our milk replacers and even pasteurized waste milk, it's already kind of a physiological solution. And we add more salt and sugar to that. The concentration of salt and sugar is going to be much too high, and that will create more problems than we're actually solving. When we're making sure that we're mixing as per label instructions and we're not feeding it with the milk, maybe we'll come back and feed it after milk, and we're continuing to feed milk as long as we have GI motility. Because it, you know, and that's the part where you're gonna have to work it out with your veterinarian. It's like, well, how do I know if there isn't GI motility? And your veterinarian, you maybe listen to him with your stethoscope, or maybe you use your reproductive ultrasound, and you can ultrasound those calves to see if the GI is still moving. Because you need a functional GI tract that's actually going to move things through. And our calves that are really, really sick might not have that. So that's when we might not use an oral electrolyte solution. So I think those are kind of the key points. Mixing in as per label, using the right product, not mixing it into milk, and then having an established protocol that working with your veterinarian about when to give it, how to give it, and so it's consistent over time.
And I would imagine that being proactive and treating calves with these therapies sooner rather than later, before, like you said, a calf is too sick to suckle and maybe consume the fluids would be the best option.
Right. Yeah, because some of our calves that, you know, that maybe they're just starting, and let's say we have this problem where calves are starting with diarrhea or scours at 10 days of age, but they're still bright and alert and wanting to drink. Those would be the really great candidates to, after milk feeding, is coming back with some oral electrolytes and making sure they always have access to fresh, clean water so they can balance their electrolyte solutions within their bodies by themselves. Their kidneys and their bodies can do that for them much better than what people can do. And then when they don't want to suckle or they don't want to stand, that's when we need to start thinking about moving to an oral esophageal feeder in our calves. And when there's no motility, that's when we're moving to intravenous fluids. And then picking what solution we want to pick will be really dependent on working with your veterinarian, whether you're starting with a hypertonic solution and then going to an isotonic like saline or hypertonic saline, things like that.
Obviously, we want to keep our animals healthy, and you've shared some really good ideas on how we can help prevent animals from getting a salmonella infection or some treatments if they do become infected. But as you mentioned earlier, this is also a disease that can impact people. If you wanted to spend a few minutes talking about how this disease can spread from animals to humans and what can be some strategies that could be put in place to prevent that spread.
Sure.
So we don't want sick people on the farm either.
Right. So, and I think this is a kind of a common thread that we talk about, even with our human physicians that work in rural practice, is that, when I'm out on farm or working on a farm, I spend more time in the diagnostic lab on campus now than I did when I was earlier in my career. But typically, we kind of think of I grew up on the farm, I've been exposed, I'm not really concerned about, what's on my hands, or, I'm working with sick animals. Do I need to think about, am I moving a pathogen, be it a virus or a bacteria or a protozoa like Cryptosporidium? Am I moving that from sick animals to younger animals that aren't sick, and am I creating infection? And the thing about Salmonella, Cryptosporidium is kind of the same thing, is that, we tend to, the most common people that we see with salmonellosis by far and away are those that are exposed to animals that are shedding salmonella. So on the farm, specifically with Salmonella Newport, we have some very pathogenic salmonellas that will cause severe disease in our cattle that we tend to see overrepresented with people who are actually working and feeding or taking care of those animals or treating them. We have another example we had recently in the past 5 years, we started in 2017, is that we had an outbreak of what we call Salmonella Heidelberg, which is, we normally have seen Salmonella Heidelberg in poultry. We hadn't really seen it much in cattle, but this particular strain really developed, and we found it. And it looks like when we went back and talked to our public health colleagues, that we really, the people that were handling those sick animals, we really saw an overrepresentation of people who were exposed to sick animals actually developing disease. So on the farm, like, what can we do to prevent that? And is the most important thing is what many of us have been doing, especially with, in the last 3 years, is wash your hands, right? Just making sure we have good biosecurity practices. And that's another thing that's really hard to do, especially if you're in a hurry, is washing your hands or washing your boots or having dedicated equipment, boots or personal protective equipment, whether that's gloves or dedicated clothing that you take off and you don't wear home. Or if you're going to eat your lunch and you're dealing with your sick cows or maybe your transition, you wash your hands before you eat, just to kind of avoid that continued spread of a pathogen. And that's really what we see with Salmonella, is that the idea of, I grew up on a farm, I've always been exposed to it, I'm not really concerned about it. Salmonella really does not care about that, and it will infect our people that are on a farm exposed to it more often than folks that are not exposed to animals. The other way we see that are things like sometimes when we have reptiles tend to shed salmonella, and that's why we say it really is not a good idea for kids under the age of 5 to be handling reptiles or to have reptiles in the home. Or, and this is another thing that's happening right now, is that on some of our ecotourism or kind of farm tours in the spring, when we have all the baby chicks and ducklings and goat kids, is, those poultry kids under 5 is kind of not a great idea to have those kids handling commercial and domestic poultry, because they tend to carry salmonella bacteria. But I think in the end of how do you stop that spread to people, it's really just about biosecurity, washing your hands, washing your boots, and not spreading it from barn to barn. When we recognize where the sources are, it gets a little bit easier, but just general hygiene and cleanliness practices will go a long way.
Those are great reminders, because I think it is really easy for many of us to just kind of go about your work and not necessarily think about what you're picking up along the way. And like you said, you might grab something to eat or touch your face or do something like that and right, be unknowingly infecting yourself or passing it to other animals or people. So I think that is all important to know. I think if we look at the big picture of Salmonella, obviously we have, when you're in the moment trying to take care of animals and limit that spread, but what are some of the long-term impacts that a Salmonella infection can have on animals, both maybe, how it can impact their future health or performance, and then the overall economic impact that a disease like this can have on a dairy farm?
Yeah, there's a lot of data out there about specifically with Salmonella Dublin, looking at losses of several hundred dollars per cow per lactation. And it really kind of depends on the farm and where they are in the infection stages. Is this the first time they're seeing Salmonella Dublin on a farm specifically with that host adapted strain? And because we have sick cows or maybe cows and calves that die or are sicker and die. And then moving forward as specifically for Salmonella Dublin, what does it do to the overall immunity or baseline level of disease on a farm? And we know this with other diseases like BVD or leukosis virus and that leading to lymphosarcoma is that we know that as a host adapted strain, it will cause a loss per cow per year with salmonellosis or Salmonella Dublin in particular. The other things that we can see, depending on when for adult cows, as adult cows, if depending when they get sick or they have issues with salmonella, it can really mute their peak milk curve or their lactation curve, which will cause a decrease in the overall production of their entire lactation. Moving from, you know, we really talked a lot of difference between adult cows and calves, and in our calves, it will decrease our daily rate of gain. We're certainly going to see calves that die, so we're going to have issues with just death loss. And then the cost to the farm to make sure that for their overall treatment protocols and how many calves are they treating. And it's not just the drugs that are being used, it's the time that's needed to actually to treat these calves too, especially when we're getting into intensive fluid therapies. It takes quite a bit of time.
In your line of work, I know you and your colleagues are often called in when a farm is in the midst of a crisis of some sort, whether it's a salmonella outbreak or something else. And I think as a way to kind of summarize the information that you've shared today, you know, let's say someone on their dairy is really, they're struggling, they have calves that are dying or adult cows that are dying, and they're in the middle of an outbreak. Like what would be your advice for them to kind of dig their way out of that hole?
Yeah, and hopefully I tend to write a lot of our Hordes veterinary columns based on kind of abnormal or strange increases in what we call morbidity and mortality on farms. And salmonella is really no different. It just kind of depends on what we start seeing from the beginning. Is what does the caseload, what does the case presentation look like? And like any infectious disease, the best way that we manage it is first we need to be able to diagnose it. We need to know how many animals have it or have a particular problem, or if we don't know what's going on, we can submit a fecal sample or a nasal swab to know what's causing that respiratory disease or the calf scours in our pre-weaned calves. So we have a diagnostic test so we know exactly what we're looking for. The most important thing for our diagnostics is to make sure that the lab itself has the most amount of information possible. We know about the history, what else is going on the farm, how big is the farm, are the calves, are they housed together or are they in individual pens? So we know a lot about what's happening when they're getting sick. And then we have some sort of management strategy, whether that's cleaning and sanitation, or we want to instill and use a vaccine during the most high risk period. And then we actually come back and have a diagnostic test of saying how good are the management strategies that we're using to kind of solve our problem. That's really no different than kind of any different type of infectious disease problem that we see on the farm. We know that salmonella is going to start coming up in the warm, wet months. And when in doubt, oftentimes in the very beginning stages is that we might miss those calves or we don't quite notice it because like right now we're busy emptying the manure lagoons or getting those fields planted. I see clouds of dust every time on my way home from campus, and that we're super busy. So we might not spend as much time in those calves as possible. Maybe there's one that dies. I wouldn't always kind of think about making sure those calves are necropsied, or the veterinarian comes out and performs a fresh necropsy, or we submit those calves to the diagnostic lab. It's very economically feasible. It will cost you more money to actually get the calf into the lab than it will to perform the necropsy. but making sure that we're not missing anything. Those a complete body necropsy really helps us really get a complete picture of what's going on, because oftentimes it's not just one problem. We might have a salmonella that we push the calf over, but maybe the calf is low body weight, they're not getting enough nutrition, or maybe they have a primary viral issue going on, or they have something else that's really potentiating a secondary infection. We see that quite a bit with Salmonella sero. Don't discount those calves that die having a necropsy done, whether you're training on-farm personnel to do those necropsies and submit samples and be there for the veterinarian to look at the next time they're doing herd health, or for the veterinarian to submit to a diagnostic lab, be it your state lab or maybe sending some samples to a private lab. So there's a lot that we can do when we recognize changes in health, especially, and that's really where our wheelhouse is infectious diseases. And Salmonella is certainly one of those things that we focus on here at our diagnostic lab in Madison.
As you alluded to, Salmonella is not picky when it comes to what humans it's going to infect or what animals or what farms. What positive trends are you seeing on farms that people are really doing well that have helped minimize the impact of Salmonella on dairies?
Sure, yeah. Those dairies that kind of are spending more time and effort into cleaning and sanitation, I think ideally the ideal state that we would see on dairies, as we see dairies getting larger, and we might see fewer either antimicrobials being able to be used or effective against pathogens like salmonellosis, that we're doing more kind of surveillance testing so we know what's happening on the farm, where are those populations. Are serotypes for Salmonella changing, or are we seeing different kind of rates of things like a BVD or respiratory disease? How are those things changing over time? We're doing regular surveillance on our dairies, and those I think are the ones where are really getting their morbidity and mortality down, as they're focusing on cleaning and sanitation, even though it's really hard, it's expensive, it's hard to see an immediate response to it. But in the end, it's one of the most important things that we can do to keep animals healthy. And then two, they're learning from their mistakes. They're looking at their data. They're involving their kind of their veterinarian and their herd checks and keeping those infectious diseases in check. And when something changes, or let's say their established protocol is not working, all of a sudden these calves that are getting sick are not responding to a particular oral electrolyte solution and adding a different treatment. That's when we need to kind of rethink. Maybe this is something different, or there's something else in the environment, or maybe there's a change in a milk replacer product, or where the environment is changing, whether it's going from spring to summer or summer to fall, is that we need to really start thinking about what else could this be so we can implement a management change earlier. Those that are really keeping a close eye on that. I mean, it requires a lot of resources putting into it, but they've recognized the return on investment for thinking about infectious diseases as what's the root upstream determinant. And it might not necessarily be just the bug, right? It might be the bug plus the environment and the farm practices all together. For Salmonella, when we think about coming, kind of bringing this back to full circle with our Salmonella Heidelberg issue, that was mainly a sale barn calf, so a dairy beef calf issue, where we're seeing infected animals coming into sale barn facilities and then dispersing out to those farms for those dairy beef to grow from there. So by finding it and tracing it back up to that root determinant, we're able to understand where is it coming from, how can we stop it at those critical control points.
Very good. Thank you so much, Dr. Keith Polson, for sharing your knowledge on this episode of the Herd It Here podcast. The information that you shared with us today will benefit dairy farmers and the people who work with them. This episode of the Herd It Here podcast is sponsored by Boehringer Ingelheim. You can find this episode and others on our podcast, which is located at hordes.com or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Through e-newsletters, webinars, podcasts, and the printed pages of Hordes Dairyman magazine, it is our goal to share useful and proven information that farmers can utilize on their operations. Thank you once again, Dr. Keith Polson from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, for joining us today. And thank you to all our listeners for joining us for this episode of the Hordes Dairyman Herd It Here podcast.